today's Taisho will be case 28 in the Mumong Kan, the Umen Kwan, the checkpoint of no barrier. Case 28 is Ryutan blows out the candle. Tokusan asked Ryutan about Zen far into the night. At last, Ryutan said, "The night is late. Why don't you retire?" Tokusan made his bows and lifted the blinds to withdraw, but he was met by darkness. Turning back to Ryutan, he said, "It's dark outside." Ryutan lit a paper candle and handed it to him. Tokusan was about to take it when Ryutan blew it out. At this, all of a sudden, Tokusan went through a deep experience and made bows. Ryutan said, "What sort of realization do you have?" "From now on," said Tokusan, "I will not doubt the words of an old priest who is renowned everywhere under the sun." The next day, Ryutan ascended the rostrum and said, "I see a fellow among you. His fangs are like a sword tree. His mouth is like a bowl of blood. Strike him with a stick, and he won't turn his head to look at you. Someday or other, he will climb to the highest peaks and establish our way there." Tokusan brought his notes on the Diamond Sutra to the front of the hall, pointed to them with a torch and said, "Even if you have exhausted the abstruse doctrines, it is like placing a hair of your head in vast space. Even though you have learned all the secrets of the world, it is like a drop of water in the great ocean." And he burned all his notes. Then, making his bows, he took leave of his teacher. Mumon's comment: before Tokusan crossed the barrier from his native place, his mind burned and his mouth uttered bitterness. He went southward, intending to stamp out the doctrine of the special transmission outside the sutras. When he reached the road to Reishu, he asked an old woman to let him have lunch to refresh the mind. "Your worship," she said, "what sort of literature do you carry in your pack?" the old woman asked. "Commentaries on the Diamond Sutra," replied Tokusan. The old woman said, "I hear it said that in that sutra, the past mind cannot be held, the present mind cannot be held, the future mind cannot be held. Now I would like to ask you, what mind are you going to refresh?" At this question, Tokusan was dumbfounded. However, he did not remain inert under her words, but asked, "Do you know of any good teacher around here?" The old woman said, "5 miles from here, you will find Priest Ryutan." Coming to Ryutan, Tokusan got the worst of it. His former words were inconsistent with his later ones. As for Ryutan, he seemed to have lost all sense of shame and compassion towards his son. Finding a bit of live coal in the other, enough to start a fire, he hurriedly poured on muddy water to annihilate everything at once. A little cool reflection tells us it was all a farce. Mumon's verse: hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. Seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name. He may have saved his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes. So this is the final day of our May 2018 session, and everyone has done a wonderful job. This morning in Dokusan, people were clearly practicing very deeply and bringing their practice into the Dokusan room. People are practicing wholeheartedly. They're willing to put themselves on the line to be open to where the koan is leading them, and the results are really wonderful. It's really my version of heaven to be practicing in this way with you all. It's really wonderful. I mean, people who want to practice are hard to find, actually. You know, and so people who want to practice wholeheartedly are even harder to find. So to have so many people here today and this week, for some portion of this week, it's really wonderful. Some of you are beginners, and this is your first experience of Sesshin. And I want to thank you for having the courage to come and try this. You know, it's a little bit intimidating just trying anything new. And it, you know, when you ask around about Sesshin, sooner or later somebody will tell you that it's challenging, and it is. And it might, you know, I have to say my first Sesshin was really a shocker. You know, I had only been practicing for a little while, and I sort of signed up not understanding what this was going to be like. I came away sold on the process. Something about it was just so liberating. And if people learn nothing else from their first Sesshin experience, it is that, you know, the great way is not difficult for those who practice a lot, right? So if you sit, you know, a couple times a week and then you come to Sesshin, that's really murder, right? But if you practice regularly, and if you, that is, almost every day, you know, I find my days are better if I do Zazen. And sometimes, if some dean at Rutgers wants to have an 8:30 meeting, you know, I'll try to talk him out of it, but I will show up, and I might not be able to sit the full amount that day. But, you know, usually I'm able to get in a sit every morning of my life. And when I don't sit, I definitely wish I had, you know. So it's just beneficial for you in so many ways just to sit. But if you practice with regularity, come to the Saturday sits too, you know, you have a chance to sit for a number of hours. And it's challenging on Saturday. But it's like coming to Sesshin, if you sit a couple times a week for half an hour, is like signing up for the marathon, right? If you jog a couple of miles a week, right? You're just not ready for the experience in some ways. So one lesson to take away from a marathon is, if you are in that category of people who run a couple of miles a week, you could say, well, I'll never do a marathon again. But another possibility after the marathon is to say, you know, this marathon thing is kind of interesting, but I'm going to have to train. And so, you know, if you make a place for Zen in your life, that means, you know, trying to do regular daily practice. And also, you know, practice every other weekend where you sit more than an hour. And, you know, the way to sort of get ready for Sesshin is to sit beyond your comfort zone, you know. So when you sit on a Saturday, we do those three sits. You know, usually the last one is a little hard, and then, you know, we have a little bathroom break, and then you come back and you do two more, and there might be a moment at which, you know, you're saying, okay, ring the bell, please ring the bell. Or ring the bell, damn it! You know, ring the bell. That's where you're deepening your concentration. It's your concentration can be deepened, and you know, if you practice regularly, you get yourself into those situations where you're thinking, ring the bell, and then you realize, okay, he's probably not going to ring the bell. I can't really make him ring. I can't send him thoughts to make him ring the bell. And then you say, okay, well, what else can I do, short of like breaking my posture and just unfolding my legs? What could I do? And then you go back into your breath, and that carries you into deep samadhi for some interval. And you know, at first, it's the ability to enter samadhi is actually like a not just a skill, but a capacity. You know, so it's very hard even to get to samadhi. Beginners have a hard time getting to samadhi. A lot of sits are just busy and uncomfortable. And this goes for sitting at the university or sitting at one of our other locations, you know. But eventually, you know, you can get into samadhi at some point in your sit with some regularity. But then, you know, you have to cultivate getting into deep samadhi and sustaining that samadhi state. See, so you know, those moments where you're sort of not comfortable usually arise when you've gone into samadhi, you've watched the breath, you've gone into samadhi, everything's going well, but then you come out of samadhi and there's still like 10 minutes left, right? And at that moment, you know, that's when you start feeling, you know, I've had it, ring the bell. But when you go back into samadhi again, you can get back into it. And little by little, you know, you'll get to a place where you can stay in deep samadhi for longer and longer periods of time. You know, the greatest Zen master of the 20th century was a Chinese man named Xu Yun, Empty Cloud. And Empty Cloud was, by all accounts, an amazing person. You know, he's had a huge impact on the revival of Buddhism in China after Deng Xiaoping. And many, many of the leaders of Chinese Buddhism were students of Xu Yun, and they said meeting him was like meeting one of these ancient Zen masters from the Tang Dynasty. You know, he just had this incredible ability to practice wholeheartedly. And in his memoir, he talks about living up on a mountain, and you can actually go to his hut. The hut where he lived is still there. There's probably a monk in there right now. But Xu Yun lived there for a time doing practice on his own. In his memoir, he said that he decided he needed to eat some rice, and so he started a little fire, put a pot of rice on the fire, and then he went into deep samadhi. And he said when he woke up, the rice was cold. You know, it was ice cold, and it was like daytime. So he had gone into such deep samadhi that probably like 12 hours had elapsed. Now, that's pretty deep samadhi. I haven't met anybody who could do that, you know. But on the other hand, Soen Roshi, people who knew the Japanese teacher Soen Roshi, said Soen Roshi would sit down on a cushion. People who knew Soen Roshi said that some days Soen Roshi would sit down on a cushion, and after 25 minutes, he'd just say, not today. You know, he was like a retired Roshi, so he could get away with that. But then, you know, they said sometimes he would sit down on the cushion and he just wouldn't move for 7 hours. There was a very famous Indian Buddhist teacher named Deepa Ma. And, you know, she used to, she had a group of very, very accomplished students. And she used to say, you know, there's nothing like sitting for 2 days. And at first, they thought she meant, you know, you mean a two-day sesshin? And she said, no, sit down and don't get up for 2 days. And people, you know, saw her do this. And actually, Xu Yun was invited. He was very famous in his time. He was invited by the king of Thailand to lead a sesshin in Thailand, in Bangkok. And he led a 7-day sesshin, and people said he didn't get up for 7 days. You know, this sounds like science fiction, but, you know, people who are known historical figures say this really happened. And many people knew Deepa Ma. She knew Jack Kornfield. She had very close associations with the Berry Insight Meditation Center. And they all say, oh yeah, this is what she used to sit down for 2 days. Xu Yun used to, when he was invited to lead Sesshin, he would actually write people and say, you must understand, I will lead the Sesshin, but I will not sit for less than 2 days. I will not sit for less than 2 days. And what he meant was, I sit down and don't bother me for 2 days. So, you know, meditation is not about how long you can sit. It's not. That would be absurd, right? It's about working through our obstacles fearlessly and cultivating awakened mind. But it's definitely the case that those are difficult to do if you can't go into deep samadhi. And, you know, I can tell when people are in deep samadhi because they're able to sit still, motionless, for long periods of time. And if you're not able to sit still and motionless for long periods of time, you're clearly not sustaining deep samadhi. So it's not the case that you're in samadhi, but you need to move your body. You're not in deep samadhi. And there was a guy who came to Rutgers last year, and he had been reading he's read all these sutras, and he'd been reading all this stuff on Zen. And he said, you know, I think I'm enlightened. And I said, really? And he said, yes, I do. And he said, you know, you're a Rinzai priest, aren't you? And I said, yes. And he said, Rinzai was famous for what is called, basically Rinzai had this system for evaluating how far along students were. He said, I'd like you to rank me, you know. And I said, okay, well, let's sit together. You know, we have three sits. And you know, after 15 minutes, he was moving around. And afterward, he said, so where am I? And I said, you're a beginner. And he didn't take it well, right? But he is, you know. It's so easy if you just read books on Buddhism. You know, I'm not, please, you know, there are, in America, I think many Zen practitioners don't read the sutras enough. You know, so I definitely think all the great Zen masters, you know, read the sutras, all of them. Even the ones who say, don't read the sutras, had all read the sutras. You know, Zen is called a transmission outside the sutras, but it really should be called a transmission in addition to the sutras, right? Or a transmission that understands that the sutras aren't enough, right? Don't do it. You know, the world is full of people like that gentleman who can read the sutras and have opinions about the sutras and sit for 20 minutes a day or an hour a day, and it's easy under those circumstances to just begin to kid yourself about how enlightened you are. You know, but then, you know, if you do come to a Wednesday night sit, you know, after two sits, you're looking for the door, right? Because your legs hurt. And that's a humbling experience, right? It's a humbling experience to realize, well, wait a minute. I thought I was deeply enlightened, but I can only sit for 20 minutes, right? You know, so again, it's not about the time. The Lankavatara Sutra, this very important sutra, says bodhisattvas cultivate long enduring minds. Bodhisattvas cultivate long enduring minds. And a long enduring mind is able to be in deep samadhi for a long period of time. It's like a long period of stable concentration, and it takes you down through the layers of the mind, and you enter mushin. And now you can begin to do the work of liberating yourself. So, the great way is not difficult for those who practice regularly. Remember that. Okay. So this is a wonderful story about Tokusan, a man named Tokusan, who actually became a very great Zen teacher in his own right. And Tokusan is a figure in the Book of Serenity. He's an important figure in Zen tradition. But he started his career as an enemy of Zen. You know, he was a scholar who read the Diamond Sutra and knew it backwards and forward. You know. And so if you had a question about the Diamond Sutra, he knew everything. He knew all the commentaries, and they even used to call his original name was Shu. So they used to call him Diamond Shu, right? It was like, you know, he studied the it'd be like Smith. He studied the Diamond Sutra so much they call him Diamond Smith. You know, he wrote the book on the Diamond Sutra. So anyway, he's one of the people who, you know, does a little sitting every day and studies the sutras. And anyway, he was giving a lecture on the Diamond Sutra, and somebody said, well, you know, you say the Diamond Sutra is indispensable to enlightenment. But, you know, there's a sect of Buddhists who say you don't have to read the Diamond Sutra to wake up. It was like he was flabbergasted. He said, what? Who says that? You know, they said they call themselves Zen. And so he just thought, this is the most outrageous thing I have ever heard in my life. You know, these frauds, these phonies. So he sets out to refute them. And he, you know, he's ready to engage in Dharma debate with them, right? So he gets some of his scrolls and his commentaries, and he packs them into his, you know, they used to have like a backpack sort of made out of wicker. So it was like a basket backpack. So he loads up his backpack and he heads out. And he's going to this region where Zen is really getting started, this part of China. And, as he's traveling, he reaches this place, which in Japanese is called Reishu. And there's an inn. He stops at the inn, and he sits down, he puts his pack down, and he says, well, the woman of the inn comes out, and he says, well, my good woman, you know, I would like I'd like a snack, basically. The Chinese word for like snack is like a mind refreshment. And I will not pronounce it right. Tianxin. So that neither of those was correct. But but the point is it's a metaphor, you know, metaphor. Refreshing the mind is a snack. So he says, I'd like a Tianxin. Then the woman notices his pack and says, you know, oh, that's interesting. What's in the pack, you know? And he says, commentaries on the Diamond Sutra. Now, you know, Zen literature was often compiled by men. And women have gotten to some degree excluded from the literature. And scholars now are rediscovering the large number of women who were masters and deeply enlightened participants in the creation of Zen tradition. In fact, some of the Indian ancestors of Zen turn out to be women. If you look at the line of Zen ancestors, there's a number of people. There's somebody called Kumarata. And in the Chinese and Japanese commentaries, Kumarata is always described as he. But some scholars have done research and said, actually, it was she. So a number of Zen so-called patriarchs are actually women. So anyway, even though women have been marginalized in Zen tradition, they turn up in Zen literature sometimes in unexpected places. And they're often in the Momonkan, these old women who seem to be ordinary people, but who are deeply enlightened. And in this case, the woman who runs the inn is a deeply enlightened person. And she sees these scrolls and says, "What are those?" And he says, "Oh, those are the Diamond Sutra." And then she challenges him with a Zen question. She says, "The old woman said, I hear it said that in that sutra," notice that she knows the sutra, "the past mind cannot be held, the present mind cannot be held, the future mind cannot be held." Now, I would like to ask you, what mind are you going to refresh? So, basically, he's had a long day of hiking. He thinks he's the smartest man on the Diamond Sutra in the world. And this woman asks him this very penetrating question that he cannot answer. And it's like, well, that is odd, isn't it? Where is my mind right now? Basically, what is the mind? I thought I knew the mind, but at this moment, I can't answer your question. And this experience, this exchange, actually produces a kind of crisis, existential crisis for Tokusan. Because he realizes, he's beginning to realize, and maybe he's already realized. Maybe one of the reasons he's reacted so angrily to Zen is that he maybe knows that he's not fully awake, right? He knows that he's not awake. He's just studied this sutra book. And I urge everybody to study the sutras, but studying the sutras is like reading a guidebook and not going to the country. So, when the woman challenges him, he can't apply his knowledge to this moment. And this is a big problem in any area of knowledge, right? I have a friend who's a math teacher, and he says, students, they'll do, if you took algebra in high school, you do the even questions this week tonight, and the odd questions tomorrow night, and different kinds of equations, and you derive the results, and then if you ask people a real question, like you're in a car. You're going to Chicago at 40 miles an hour, and a car at 80 miles an hour is passing you. You might have gotten an A on the test, when you just did the questions, but it's like, I have no idea how to apply this math, right? So this is the same thing, here. He knows the formulas, but he has no idea what it means in his, it hasn't changed his actual experience of the moment at all. His perceptual habits haven't changed, and so he kind of realizes this. And most people would block this out. Most people would just say, "Oh, what do you know? You're just some old woman who runs a restaurant. Who cares about you? I'm the great don." But instead, he's already a pretty decent human being. He realizes, I've really just been shown up. I have no idea how to answer that question. So he says something quite remarkable. He says, is there somebody I could learn, study with? Which is extraordinary. There are other cases of this in Buddhist history too. There are a number of Tibetan teachers who, there was a man named Naropa, in Tibet, who was basically like the dean of Nalanda University. And he was sort of like Diamond Shu. He was deeply learned, and one day he realized, this is all just book learning. I don't know anything about, I can't apply this. I don't know, I still experience the world of samsara in every possible way. I have not been liberated by these studies. And so Naropa went to study with Tilopa. And Tilopa was this non-conventional teacher who, they had many adventures together and so on. But he had to go from the idea to real practice. So in this case, Tokusan goes to study with Ryutan. Ryutan must be the old woman's teacher, right? She knows all about Ryutan, and she says, go see Ryutan. So she goes to see he goes to see Ryutan, and then we get the story of he starts practicing with Ryutan, and he's still the professor, you know? So he goes into Dokusan, and Ryutan's probably too kind to cut it off. You know, in a classical Zen training, the teacher can cut it off. I don't use a bell because we're all in the same building. The bell would be ringing all the time. But usually in Zen, when the teacher wants to cut the conversation off, he just rings the bell. So it actually happened to me quite often when I went to see Genki Roshi, I'd be in like mid-sentence and it would be like, oh, and I'd be gone. Okay. So, Tokusan is rambling on and on and on, and Ryutan is just patiently listening, and then the Dokusan would finally end. But on this occasion, Tokusan is rambling on and on. In other words, he's still in he isn't in deep samadhi, right? He isn't in deep samadhi. He's just in his thinking mind. And basically, Ryutan is thinking, how can I help this guy, you know? And then he tries something. He comes up with sort of a tactic, right? He says, listen, well, actually, Tokusan has talked so long. It maybe the Dokusan started at like 4:30, and it's gone on for so long. When they look outside, it's night, right? So it's a long Dokusan. And Ryutan says, "Oh my God, you've talked so long. It's night, you know." He says, "Look, you know, now you're going to need a candle to get back to the Zendo. So here, let me light you a candle." And he lights him a candle, and he hands it to Tokusan. Ryutan lights a candle and hands it to Tokusan. And as soon as Tokusan takes the candle, Ryutan blows it out. So the koan is really saying, what did Tokusan experience when Ryutan blew out the candle? See? And this is the question you must answer if you're working. You have to see what Tokusan saw. But this koan is really about how to practice Zen, right? The life of Zen. And the life of Zen is the life of deep samadhi, right? Deep samadhi. And getting beyond that level of the thinking mind, right? And we say unified mind in accord with the way. That's really samadhi. And in fact, it's clear that something changes in Tokusan. And the next day, Ryutan gets up. We do Teisho on the floor. But in a traditional Zen temple, there'd be a little platform where the teacher delivers the Teisho, like a rostrum, right? So the next day, Ryutan ascended the rostrum and said, "I see a fellow, there's one of you out there," he says, "who's like a monster of Zen," right? He's a Zen monster, right? His fangs are like a sword tree. His mouth is like a bowl of blood. So he's saying somebody has crossed over into becoming a different person, right? Somebody has become a different kind of human being. And he said, Nat, you strike that guy with this stick and he won't even turn to look at you. In other words, he's in such deep samadhi. That if you hit him, he doesn't care, right? It's like, what was... this is really not... nobody's going to hit you, right? But, when I first had my real first experience of deep samadhi we were building our temple in the mountains outside of Seattle. It was called Tokuganji. And, you know, we all dedicated, like, we would all give up a week or two of our summer and go up and work on building the temple. It was amazing. And all the membership of our group participated. You know, we would all go up there, and we were living in tents, and we poured the footings, and we framed the building. We put it up. We put up the roof. We put, a metal roof on the frame roof. We did all this work. And the thing is, we had a sesshin scheduled for that summer in that building. And at that time, it was summer anyway, so there was no problem. But we hadn't yet, we ran out of money before we could put windows in at that time. We eventually did put windows in. But we were having sesshin in the zendo, and there were no windows. So, you know, all kinds of things would fly through, bugs and... So anyway, the Genki Roshi was giving his talk and his teisho, and a bee flew through the window, and he landed on my hand. And I was listening to Genki Roshi, and I was looking. I saw the bee come, and I saw him land on my hand, and it was like I could see every hair on his, you know, bees have hairs, you know. It wasn't a bumblebee, it was like a honeybee or something. And he has hairs, they have hairs on their back, and I could see everything. And I could see his abdomen go up, and the stinger began to point down, and the stinger went right into my hand, right? And I could, I thought I was going to go, yow, you know. And I was in deep samadhi. I was listening to Genki, and I was trying not to move. So I was watching my breath, right? And when you in really deep samadhi, it almost feels like sometimes like your body disappears, right? And, you know, this beast put his stinger in my hand, and I thought I was going to be in pain. And it was like nothing happened. And after the... And it was amazing. I was like, did that just happen? And after that was over, after the teisho, I got up and I walked out, and about half an hour later, my hand really hurt like hell. You know, it's not a parlor trick, you know. However, you know, it's kind of cool. You can be stung by bees and it won't hurt you, you know. But it's really about, you know, it's about, the Dalai Lama once said, Buddhism is about totally, how did he put it? He said, the total transformation of the human being. The Dalai Lama said, Buddhism is about the total transformation of the human being. And when we hear that, we think, oh, that would be nice, maybe, because obviously people are screwed up, right? But when they say total, when the Dalai Lama says total transformation, you know, Zen, Tibetan Buddhism also, Zen takes that very seriously. You know, earlier in the sesshin, I said, you know, what we do is, you know, we rebuild your awareness from the ground up. So going into deep mushin, into deep emptiness, is like the point zero. It's like dying and coming back to life and starting your life again. And, you know, the koans are designed to sort of like take you to reconstruct your mind, reconstruct your consciousness, but now not with the self at the center, but with, you know, with the world at the center, you could say. It's rebuilding your consciousness from something that's isolated into something that's integrated. And this process also includes the body. So when we do zazen, we're purifying body, mind, and heart. So we're rebuilding our perceptual habits. But we're also rebuilding the way our physical body functions and experiences the world. And part of that is deep samadhi is not just about how you perceive a flower or how you hear birds. It's actually like a whole body transformation. It's like rebuilding your experience of your own flesh and bones. So, you know, the disappearing body, and the body disappears on the cushion, and it comes back like your mind in a different way. It's the total transformation of the human being. This is why some koans have this element of action. You know, like calling Mu in the kitchen. It's one thing to be able to discover the blankness that is real, right? To call Mu and suddenly you notice there's this blankness and you immerse yourself in that blankness. All thoughts disappear when you're really deeply in that blankness. And, you know, you go through a kind of psychological transformation in the presence of that emptiness. But, you know, that insight alone isn't fully transformative. You actually have to embody that emptiness. You have to go into the Zendo and call Mu. And, of course, the whole time you're preparing to go into the Dokusan room, you're thinking... going to the Dokusan room and call Mu. The whole time you're preparing to go into the Dokusan room, you're thinking, oh crap, he's probably going to want me to call Mu. You know, how am I going to do it? And the more you think about it, the more paralyzing it is, right? So if you're trying to, you say, should I call loud or soft? You know, that's the wrong way to go about it. I know this from years of experience, right? I mean, having spent many years on the Mu koan, you know, I had just totally given up. I thought, I will never answer this koan. I'm just going to go in again and, you know, call Mu. And I opened my mouth and I didn't speak. I'm not kidding you. Something deep inside of me roared, you know. And it was amazing. I was amazed. I thought, did that come from me, right? So that's called Zen spontaneity. It's the integration of emptiness and your body in action. You know, there are other koans that require this too. You know, it's not just a Mu koan. Some koans are asking you to do a particular thing, you know, and they don't tell you what it is. So it says, do something, and we won't tell you what it is. So you have to go into deep mushin until you can activate your big mind, and then eventually you know what to do. And in some koans, there are actual particular gestures that are expected, sort of normal, and that's really quite amazing considering that these koans were created in the 7th century in China, and you give the koan to an American in the 21st century and you get the same gesture. Please think about that, you know, for a while. But not during sesshin. So, the total transformation of the human being begins with one-pointed attention to the breath, followed by entry into samadhi, and samadhi leads to shunyata, emptiness, or the samadhi of shunyata. And that is the door into your big mind. And when you can begin to access your big mind, the total transformation of the human being begins. And the goal of the process is the production of a bodhisattva, a person who is fully integrated into the world, and in a way that is basically motivated by compassion and wisdom. So, everybody is on this path. And I thank you so much for your efforts. We have hours left, and many koans are unanswered, and there is still time. So please continue to make an excellent effort.